Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. This week's guest is the LBC radio host, James O'Brien. James grew up in Kidderminster in the 1970s and 80s with his adoptive parents, Joan and Jim O'Brien. He attended Ampleforth College, the famous Catholic public school in Yorkshire. In 2018, the school was named in a report into historic child abuse. He describes his school years as rebellious, but reflects that the weird burning sense of injustice he felt was pretty well placed. Following in his father's footsteps, James pursued a career in journalism and got his foot in the door thanks to a chance encounter with John Major. Although he started out in print, he later segued into broadcast, starting his LBC show in 2004. In this episode, we discuss the impossibility of impartiality, what he thinks of Nigel Farage's appearance on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and receiving hate on social media.
One of the great advantages I have is that the people who really hate me are mostly disgusting racists.
Yeah.
So it actually becomes quite easy to convert it into a badge of honour.
Plus, we discuss imposter syndrome, being not a very good journalist, and what he gets up to on Christmas Day. James O'Brien, welcome to the Radio Times podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'd ask how your journey was, but I already know it was swift.
It's swift and moist.
And moist, yes. It's a very rainy, miserable day, isn't it? We're going to go everywhere with this conversation. It's going to be telly chat, which I hear you like telly.
I love television.
Yeah, this surprised me.
Did it?
Yeah, I almost feel like because of your job, everything you're going to consume is going to be quite serious.
No.
Right, let's start with, firstly, what is the view from your sofa? Talk me through your living room setup.
Well, I mean, slightly annoyingly for these purposes, we're in the middle of building work at the moment. So, so we've got a kind of makeshift sitting room. There's a grand piano in there, which sounds very grand.
Yes.
But we inherited that. That came with the house because it turns out it's more expensive to get rid of a grand piano than it is to let the people buying the house in which the previous owners installed it keep it. It's very old. Yeah. So that's there. And the to my left of the sofa. And then there's another sofa to my right. And the telly is sort of perched precariously on a bookcase, on a built-in bookcase. This is at the moment. God knows what it's going to be like when if we ever finish. And it means that all four of us can sit in sort of quite close proximity with a big round coffee table in front of us for eating off or for keeping drinks on. And you can close the curtains and it becomes a very cozy little den, ideal for TV immersion.
Could we treat our listeners to some of your Christmas Day happenings? So could you talk me through?
I'm going to confess something that might get me into trouble, but if we go to my in-laws for Christmas... I don't get sprouts. And I start getting cross about this in about mid-November. I start saying to my wife, do you think they'll do sprouts this year? And my wife will say, I don't know, ask them. I said, I can't ask them. I don't want. One year they did a sprout coleslaw. Can you believe that? On Christmas Day, a sprout coleslaw.
That's vile.
So I'm already thinking about that. My daughters are still of an age where they will enjoy opening their presents on Christmas Day, but happily they won't come and jump on my head at 4 o'clock in the morning in expectation of opening them. I love giving presents. I don't know why. I really, really love treating people to special presents, and it gets very hard to get the right presents as the children get older. But yeah, Christmas is a really lovely day. I'm magical about Christmas, and it will involve, well, I was going to say a slap-up feed with all the trimmings, but there is obviously one trimming that will be
overlooked,
notable only by its absence. But a slap-up feed, presents, and that lovely, you never feel quite as full as you do at 6 o'clock on Christmas Day, do you?
Delightful.
And then, of course, we'll have to find out what's on the telly.
Yes. Any TV watching that you return to year on year?
I mean, younger people find it impossible to imagine what it was like to just check the Radio Times and see if The Wizard of Oz was on, or to see when it was on, because it was almost always on, but it would be on at different times. One year it might be on December the 30th. Another year they might be on BBC Two at 6 o'clock on Boxing Day. So I would always, always want to watch The Wizard of Oz when I was young, and I still will. As a kid, the only Fools and Horses Christmas specials were second only to Mass as religious events, but there's nothing quite like that anymore, is there? There's nothing quite as appointment to watch as an Only Fools and Horses Christmas special.
I love a Christmas special.
Oh, yeah.
So do you watch together? Who gets
try
control?
To. It's a big thing of mine to try to find things that we can watch together. But it is, I wouldn't say it was a losing battle, but it's a very difficult battle because my daughters watch in 8-hour chunks. They will inhale a box set. I'll say, how are you getting on with that show? And she go, yeah, I'm on series 4.
Yep,
and I'll say,
nice.
But you only started watching it on Monday. So that's very different. They're also, of course, that generation are allergic to what I recently discovered we're supposed to call linear television. So the idea that there's an appointment to view, which was absolutely integral to me growing up, to our family viewing, you know, if it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, it's Cracker Jack. But they obviously they don't do that as well because most shows drop in their entirety. But there are a few that fit into the category. So traditions at the moment would involve, we like British crime dramas, quite gentle crime dramas. So we watch Midsummer Murders together, if there's a new Midsummer Murders, or even actually old ones. But again, my daughters run ahead of me and end up watching all of them before we've got around to reconvening. And we love Death in Paradise. Ralph Little is actually a mate of mine, so he's very kindly, when the girls were sort of just young enough to be amazed by this kind of thing, he'd record a little message for them from the set. I'd surprise them with it just before the new series started, and they couldn't quite calculate how the character was also on my phone screen and then appearing 10 minutes later on television. And that was linear. That was always dropping, a new episode dropping at the same time. And then on Monday nights, we do what I imagine quite a lot of families do, and we do the triple quiz run together. So we do Mastermind, University Challenge, and Only Connect.
How do you get on?
They're pretty well, actually. I mean, Only Connect is the interesting one. It took me a while to get into that.
Yeah.
I kind of knew I should be into it because of all the people who raved about it, being people who I sort of admire or feel simpatico with. And I'm finally getting the hang of it now, but I'm nowhere near good enough to appear on it. I'm good at general knowledge. I'm good on the other two. I've done the celebrity versions of Mastermind and University Challenge very much enthusiastically. And the rest of the family like piling in on that as well. So that's become a bit of a tradition in recent months, which has been lovely.
Yeah, it's really nice, I think, when you have something that means you can all get together.
And special.
Actually, you know, I grew up with terrestrial telly and watching, you know, strictly on a Saturday and having that evening time together. And actually it becomes kind of the TV as the heart of almost like a fire.
Yes,
in some
exactly
ways.
That. Yes. We went through phases of Strictly. This series hasn't engaged as much. Again, Krishnan is a pal of mine. So I've watched his adventures with great interest and Amanda Abington as well, who of course pulled out early, but the kids haven't really engaged with this episode. I don't know why. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But that's the classic example of good old-fashioned Saturday night TV, isn't it? And, you know, if you can get that right, then you've got all generations gathered around.
Yeah.
I read once, I don't know if this is true, I read once that the television plays the role of a fire in the sort of in the Neanderthal part of our minds, for men, not for women. So men would return from a hard day's hunter-gathering, and they would just sit and stare at the fire while the women got on with the business of looking after the children or preparing whatever the men had hunted and gathered. Don't look at me like that. This is proper history.
This is proper
anthropology.
I think Stephen Fry told me...
Did he? Something similar?
Yes.
Oh, it must be true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Copper bottom guarantee there, vindication. And it doesn't matter what's on. For a man, you can just stare at the flickering lights and still feel a degree of succor and calm that I think my wife finds hard to understand. She'll say, "What are you watching?" And I can reasonably reply quite often, "I've got no idea.
Just lost
all.
It. What yes. do you think about celebrities going on these kind of quiz shows or panel shows? We've just heard that Farage is going on I'm Celeb.
Oh, that's very different from going on Mastermind or University Challenge. I'm deeply troubled by Enoch Powell Tribute Act being taken as a valid contributor to public discourse, let alone a suitable candidate for light entertainment. But that's the way the country's gone in recent years, and it can sometimes feel like a lonely battle to oppose it. But it will be. I don't think I'll be watching it. But it's hard to think of anyone who suffered profound reputational damage by going on that show, which is odd when you think about it, because we tune in expecting people to shame themselves or embarrass themselves.
Yeah.
But even Matt Hancock can come out with his reputation temporarily enhanced. So I doubt that anyone hoping that, that his mask slips or the real Farage emerges. I suspect they'll be disappointed.
Yeah. What about radio? Do you listen to lots of radio shows? What would be your favourite?
Well, that's a tricky question, because you would expect me to praise my colleagues to the rafters, but my favourite radio show is probably Desert Island Discs and then The Archers. So it's the Sunday morning omnibus and then Lauren Laverne, who I think does a brilliant job on Desert Island Discs. I'm also a big fan of radio drama, which is an acquired taste. Not everybody likes that, but a really good dramatisation on the radio can take you away, you know. That it's a bit of a cliche, but the pictures are better on the radio. And if you're listening to, you know, a dramatization of a Dickens or an Alexandre Dumas or something where you really get caught up in the action, you can just close your eyes and see it all unfolding in front of you. I love doing that. And that, of course, sometimes makes long journeys fly by as well. So I listen to a lot of speech radio. I think Chris Moyles on Radio X is fantastic, but obviously I have to get across the news in the morning, so I can't listen to music radio as much as perhaps I would do if I didn't have this stupid job.
The job is intense. Do you feel like you always have to have your finger on the cultural pulse?
Not really. My dad was a newspaper journalist, so radio in the car would have been the Today programme on Radio 4 when he still drove me to school every day, which was only until I was about 10. But it gets stuck in your DNA, doesn't it? It gets kind of part of your muscle memory. So I would always have some form of news on in the morning on the way to work. I stopped when things just got too bleak.
Yeah.
COVID, I stopped. And some of the post-Brexit period, I stopped. I just thought, I can go on air. I know what's going on. And I've from a very early age, had a facility with newspapers where I can inhale what's in the papers without necessarily reading it all. So I've generally got a fairly good idea by about 9:45 in the morning of what's going on in the world. And from those pickings, we'll decide what we're going to talk about on the radio programme.
Did you watch Partygate on Channel 4?
No, I didn't. I mean, it's there. I keep meaning to watch it, but I always enjoy things like that once I actually watch them. But it's a bit like, it's not a busman's holiday exactly, but it's certainly not escapism. And most of my viewing choices would probably get filed under escapism. And yet then when I do something a little bit more nourishing or a little bit more substantive, then I almost always enjoy it. It's just that initial...
initial
leap up to the deep end rather than the slightly shallower end where I like to spend most of my time.
We did a study recently called the Radio Times Screen Test, and what came out, I think, is not really that much of a surprise in the sense that people who engage more often with news tend to feel very anxious afterwards. But obviously, if you are so heavily involved in the news, or you have to be so on it in terms of knowing what's going on, and you can't really take an escape. How do you deal with that, and how do you make sure that doesn't become too taxing?
Well, I think possibly there's a bit of exposure therapy in play here, Kellyanne, because I'm exposed to it so much that it doesn't really discombobulate me. I think it's probably one of those things like working in a chocolate factory where you're supposed to go off chocolate, aren't you, after about the first week on the production line. So it doesn't really, I suppose it's a form of detachment in that you can't stop seeing the stories as human. You can't stop seeing the people in the news as human. But generally, you can keep a little bit of emotional distance from it, so you don't end up feeling anxious or discombobulated. There are exceptions. You know, recent events in the Middle East, which we covered more or less uninterrupted for 2 weeks straight, takes a proper psychic... If you're doing a job properly, it takes a proper psychic toll. When we covered the Grenfell Tower tragedy, I was at the BBC, and they're very good at offering counselling to journalists and production staff who are dealing with human misery and tragedy on the kind of scale that nobody should have to. We're journalists. We're not emergency services or you know, people in the very, very front line of trauma. But it doesn't mean that you won't be traumatized. But these are exceptional events. The general day-to-day diet of news doesn't really affect me deeply.
Did you take them up on that offer?
Of counselling, not for that. I was already having therapy, so I didn't particularly need the specific offer of counselling. And I was coping with it pretty well because my show is about talking, not just reporting. So if you're doing a news... Newsnight is different, but I was doing the radio show at the same time as well. If you're talking to people who've been caught up in it, there's a therapeutic element to that conversation, i.e. you can work through a lot of the emotions, and you can talk about a lot of the things that you can't when you're doing a straight news report. The hard thing about news reporting is objectivity. It's distance. I couldn't be a... It's hard to say this without sounding like I'm criticizing the people who do it, but I don't think I am capable of watching a starving child, for example, without wanting to give them all my dinner. Do you see what I mean? And I don't think I could do that job. Whereas I can talk to people about what it has been like to lose someone or to escape from Grenfell and therefore go to slightly different places than you would if you were a straight news reporter.
Yeah. In terms of conversations, I listened to the Reith lectures last year, which Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie did, and she was talking about the kind of freedom of speech and how she feels as a society. We have become so polarized that sometimes we aren't even able to have a conversation with each other for fear of saying the wrong thing or for saying something that doesn't align with our political camp. How important is it through things like your show that we are engaging and actively having these conversations?
I mean, I think we sometimes get a bit carried away on this argument these days, because what a lot of people, if you're looking at the Donald Trump style demands for free speech, they're often demanding the right to tell lies unchallenged, you know, and they don't pretend otherwise. Kellyanne Conway talks about alternative facts, and you can see what happens when you treat the babblings of QAnon or the January the 6th incitements of Donald Trump as if they were evidence-based or fact-based. An entire population can be corrupted. So it's a bit unfashionable, but I think we allow too much freedom of speech into the public space without properly policing whether it's, you know, observably true or not. And the British equivalent of that would probably be Boris Johnson dancing around claiming that he'd got all the big calls right during COVID, when we have discovered, if you didn't know already during the COVID inquiry, that the precise opposite was true. He got almost everything wrong. And then you move into the area that I think you're probably talking about more directly, which is offence. And the right to cause offence, which is obviously something that needs to be protected up to a point. But I don't think we stop often enough to ask why you want to cause offence. Why are you so keen to malign the Black Lives Matter movement? Why do you want to be free to say that people born under a different star or born under a different religion or born with a different skin tone to you are not properly British? I mean, by all means, remind me of why it's important that you have the right to say it, but explain to me as well why you're so desperate to all the time. It just seems quite an odd way to go about living.
They say, I mean, a lot of the articles that I read in preparation for this have kind of, you know, thanks, I did my research. They weave into it often this phrase, which is that you are very good at shutdowns, and these shutdowns take off online and on social media. Do you think that you do?
Less so recently. I think when I became, whatever word you prefer, well-known, I'd been doing the job for well over a decade before anybody really noticed me, to be honest. And it was largely in the aftermath of Brexit that the spotlight kind of found me a bit as a consequence of technology. We just had the cameras in the studio. I think they introduced the cameras for other presenters who would be interviewing politicians, or on the music stations, they'd have Taylor Swift coming in or Ed Sheeran, and they were going to be clipped up and then packaged for social media. And they were the ones that were supposed to go viral. But to everyone's surprise, most of all mine, me just sort of ranting at the moon with no one else in the studio was the stuff that first hit the sort of million view marks and stuff like that. And then the callers would ring in, and it's not a shutdown. It's in many ways, it's the opposite of a shutdown, although I'm perfectly comfortable with the word. It's something that doesn't happen much in the media. And it ties back to what we were saying a moment ago about observable reality and provable truth. Someone would say to me with their full chest something that I thought was nonsense, and I would just ask them to justify what it was that they'd said. So in the context of Brexit, it would be most obviously, it would be, why do you want to leave? Because I'm sick of all the laws. I'm sick of all the laws that the EU has introduced. And I would simply say, well, what laws are you most looking forward to saying goodbye to? And someone would just stop. And it's astonishing that the discourse in the country had never once paused to interrogate this catchphrase. It had become a catchphrase. There'd be people dancing around television studios, you know, politicians and pundits issuing this phrase without ever once being stopped to explain what they meant by it. So when a member of the public comes on the show and repeats it, they're not really expecting to be asked to do something that their political heroes haven't been asked to do. But as soon as you say it, it falls apart in spectacular fashion. And I think people quite like the jeopardy of it. And the silence of it sometimes, you know, when you can hear somebody going, oh God, how have I ended up live on the radio with absolutely nothing to offer up in response to a really, really simple question. So they're not shutdowns in the sense that I'm smashing people over the head with my opinions or my knowledge. They're kind of exercises in giving people enough rope. And it doesn't happen as much as it used to, because we've moved away from Brexit, and partly I think, you know, without being immodest, you're unlikely to be listening to my program without knowing my modus operandi. Whereas for a while, I think I got away with inviting people to ring in who didn't know quite what was going to happen when they did.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting asking people to unpick things that we have come to believe are facts and aren't.
Yes, it's extraordinary. Even this week, someone rang in to praise the reappointment of David Cameron by Rishi Sunak, because he's got such a good foreign policy record, which I've also read this week. But I said, what's on it? What's on his foreign policy? What are his great foreign policy achievements? And the poor fellow was, well, he won an election. I said, that's not really a foreign policy achievement. So, but there, you know, these things get into the public vocabulary, and I'm fascinated by whether or not they should actually be there.
Yeah, and we don't really question it.
And that's when the mad stuff happens. That's when the crazy stuff happens. You know, that's when the alternative facts are treated with the same respect and authority as the actual facts. Mm. And it's what happens when you get people in studios offering up two sides of an argument, where sometimes it seems, particularly at the Beeb, even if you had someone who believed that the earth was round, they'd have to book someone who believes the earth was flat for what they like to call balance, which, again, I think is a bit bonkers.
So you left the Newsnight, and that was in part because of your...
It wasn't in part. It was entirely because I couldn't really sustain the three issues at the time that I needed to be opinionated about in all my other work were Brexit, Donald Trump, and Boris Johnson. So now that all three of those have turned out so fantastically, I obviously feel very stupid.
What about impartiality? How easy do you think that is now?
Well, how can you be impartial on whether or not Donald Trump and Boris Johnson are fit people to run governments? It's not a question of impartiality. It's a question of counting. But you are required to be. And in Britain, a lot of the policing of that is done by right-wing newspapers. So you can have a background in right-wing student politics, or you can publish a very right-wing magazine, and no one's got a problem with you presenting programmes on the BBC. But there's a chap in my new book who is a 25-year-old fact-checker on his first ever shift on the Daily Politics. And the next day he's in every right-wing newspaper in the country because he once uploaded a picture of his dog to a Facebook page called Dogs for Jeremy Corbyn. And this is apparently proof that he can't be trusted to be impartial. But then there's a significant number of people who've got clear right-wing histories and right-wing connections who can. So even that's bogus. You should be able to do a job for the BBC regardless of what your opinions are. The problem is that only people with opinions, suspected opinions, that the Daily Mail or the Daily Telegraph is comfortable with, avoid the kind of scrutiny and spotlight that's directed at people like Emily Maitlis or Lewis Goodall. And it's just an obvious injustice. It's an obvious imbalance, which again, people seem shy of talking about.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Can we journey back to your childhood and talk about, you said at the beginning that TV watching was a family affair. What's your first TV memory?
I tell you, I used to, finding things my dad found funny. So moving from cartoons to dad would laugh at something and I would find it funny too. And that's a magical moment because you have that sense of growing up and that sense of camaraderie with your parents as well. I don't know what my very earliest television memory would be. I more morning than evening. I remember the school holidays when Why Don't You would be on. Why don't you turn off your television set and go and do something less boring instead? And we had this weird little cubbyhole under the stairs, which looking back, that was obviously where Mum and Dad would stick me and my sister to sort of keep us out of the way, and we'd be glued to the telly in there, and there was a few programs on in the mornings during the school holidays that you'd just be transported by. So that's quite an early memory. And then I remember my dad laughing while I was in bed, so I'd be upstairs in bed and his laughter would come through the floorboards, and that would be the Two Ronnies or Morecambe and Wise. I remember Morecambe and Wise because that bridges the gap in a way. Eric Morecambe is a classic clown. And so that bridges the gap from cartoons to adult, you know, actual humans doing funny things. So, you know, it's hard to remember whether you actually remember it or just whether you've seen it so many times since. But when Eric Morecambe would slap Ernie Wise around the chops, or that famous moment with Andre Previn, stuff like that. And then I remember a joke. I don't know how old I was, but it was the Jasper Carrot Show. And it was a joke that I got. And I got it properly. And I forget how old I was, but I was young. And it was someone based on Prince Charles who'd arrived at university with his bodyguard and was standing on the balcony smoking a cigarette, I think, and waxing lyrical about how wonderful university life was. And he said to his bodyguard, "Why didn't you go to university, Perkins?" And his bodyguard replied, "I got the same A-level grades as you, sir." And I just remember thinking that I get that. That's really funny. And it's also quite political. And it's got, you know, there's quite a lot going on in that joke. And that's quite an early memory of understanding grown-up comedy. And I told that story on the radio about 15 years ago. And the bloke that wrote the joke was listening, which is remarkable because back then there were only about 200,000 people a week tuning in. And he was actually one of them. And he sent me an email and it was, you know, it was all kosher. And I don't know why that just tickled me pink. There was a lovely sort of symmetry to it.
Full circle.
Yeah.
So you were adopted as a baby.
Yeah.
Were you told from the off?
Yes. Yeah, I never didn't know, which I think, again, you don't want to sit in judgment on other people's choices, but certainly from the point of view of my emotional security, it seems to me to be the very best way to deal with it. You never don't know. So in that sense, it's never actually that big a deal to you. It might be to other people. It is, it remains, but other people are fascinated by it. But to my sister and I, it's the most normal thing in the world.
Your sister is adopted too. Mm. Right. So tell me a little bit about home life. What were you like as a child?
I was a terrible show off, which will come as a major shock, I'm sure, to anyone who's familiar with my work. Real look at me, mum, look at me, mum, look at me, mum kind of kid. Be out on my bike a lot. We started boarding at 10, so weekly boarding at 10. So then you live this strange dichotomy where, you know, you're at home for only half of the year or a small part of the year. But before that, lovely, idyllic childhood. Lots of telly, lots of football in the garden, lots of knocking on neighbours' doors asking if they were coming out to play, lots of bike riding. We moved to a little slightly more rural area when I was a little older, and I'd disappear for hours on end. I could really enjoy my own company then. I'd get on my bicycle with a packet of sandwiches and I'd cycle as far as I could, eat the sandwiches and then cycle back. And I used to love doing that kind of thing.
That's very sweet.
It was sweet. It was. I mean, the problem with boarding school is that your friends don't live near you in the holidays. Mm. And as the years pass, you lose touch with the friends that you had from the area. Yeah. So you had to enjoy your own company in the holidays. And then in term time, the opposite was the case because you were living cheek by jowl with, you know, 500 other lads. So you'd get very little time to yourself. So quite a duality of experience. But I was essentially quite a happy kid, never more so than when I was sitting in front of the telly.
So it was Ampleforth College. Mm. What was it like for you?
Spartan. It was, I mean, very oddly Spartan. I was quite rebellious against teachers. And looking back, rightly so, actually. It was a fairly cliched anti-authoritarian streak. But, you know, without going into too much detail, there were some pretty terrible things going on at that school at the time. They didn't happen to me, the worst things. But it was clear that this curious combination of scholastic and divine authority was empowering men to do terrible things to children. And I lived most of my life at Ampleforth with a weird burning sense of injustice, a real us versus them kind of attitude, which obviously got me into quite a lot of trouble and was sometimes quite misplaced. But as I say, in retrospect, it was pretty well placed most of the time. I didn't like compulsory sport, which is one of the great regrets of my life. So my more cliched rebellion sort of segued into refusing to do things that I was required to do. Mm-hmm. So compulsory rugby turned me off, and yet I wasn't that bad at rugby, and I really liked it. But just, you know, like a stubborn kid, I'd get out of it all the time. I'd fake injuries, or I'd hide in the art room, or I just wouldn't go because it was compulsory. And that now that I'm too old and my knees are shot, I'm never going to have that kind of second wind or that third age. I really, really, really regret that. And partly as well because rugby was a religion at my school. You know, you could I used to win public speaking competitions on a national level, and nobody gave a monkey's. And I got into the National Youth Theatre, and nobody gave a fig. But if you got a call up for a trial to play rugby for Yorkshire, you were carried on your friend's shoulders through the school. And I always thought that was pretty unfair as well, because it's much harder to get into the National Youth Theatre than it was to get a trial for bloody Yorkshire. But hey ho, Lawrence Dallaglio, I did all right, and he played rugby at our school.
Where did the idea of journalism come from?
My dad was a journalist. My dad was a newspaper journalist, and I never really wanted to do anything else except possibly act, and then a vague political ambition when I was very young, but I grew out of that quite quickly. So newspapers and perhaps a little bit unimaginatively, actually, I just thought I'd follow my dad into his profession, which wasn't easy. And I was selling suits on Regent Street, having been turned down for every traineeship under the sun. And John Major bought a white suit off us. And I gave the story to the William Hickey column at the Daily Express. And when they offered to pay me money, I asked for a couple of shifts instead. And I got my foot in the door and never left. And that's how it all started. But much to my shock and dismay, I wasn't very good at it. I can write.
Yeah.
And I can talk. And talking in conference, in editorial conference, can be quite a big substitute for actually being a good journalist. So my dad was a proper news journalist,
right,
with contacts, shorthand, lots of time on the road. I didn't recognize stories. So I kind of, blagged isn't quite the right word, but I ended up show business editor, God knows how. And I never got the hang of it. I'd open the Daily Mail. I was on the Daily Express. I'd open the Daily Mail some mornings and I'd see a story on page 3, which for a showbiz editor is, you know, the holy grail. That's what you're aiming for. We need a 3. The news editor would say, we need a 3. And I'd open I'd see what the Daily Mail had got on page 3 and I'd go, oh no, I knew that. I didn't realize it was a story. I was absolutely rubbish. There was one occasion, the ITV had a chart show like Top of the Pops. It didn't last that long, but it was identical in format. And I was down there enjoying the hospitality and the free booze and the canapes. That bit of the job I was great at. And Chris Evans was there and he came out of Jerry Halliwell's dressing room. And I remember thinking, oh, that's nice. It's good that they're friends. And of course, the next day, every other newspaper had the burgeoning romance between Chris Evans and Jerry Halliwell. And I sat there staring at it going, I think you're in the wrong game, mate.
If
that was under your nose. How could you possibly have missed that? But I did. So when the...
There is nothing worse.
No, it's an awful feeling. Yeah. And then at the other bit of the job, which is even more traumatic, is when the news editor, the night editor, will ring you at about midnight and just start shouting at you because the other papers have got stories that you should have. So, and he was a lovely bloke, actually. Some of the news editors I worked for were not. But the night editor was a lovely fella, and I just used to apologize to him. I went through a period of claiming that everybody else was making it all up. That I got away with that for a while. It's just not true. I said, it's just not true, Terry. Seriously, trust me. It's just not true. I've spoken to Elton's people. It's all a load of nonsense. But that it can't be true of every single story that you failed to get. So it wasn't a very long period of my career, but looking back, it felt like centuries. So it was just a constant battle against my own incompetence.
You said that your dad didn't have the easiest ride as a journalist. That makes me think, A, why did you want to go into it?
Well, he didn't. It wasn't so much that he didn't have an easy ride. It's that he kind of topped out in a way that people who go to schools like mine don't, you know. He didn't move to London and then he got made redundant in 1990 by the Daily Telegraph and he didn't want to move to London. So what I've said about Dad is that after that period, things weren't great for him. I think he needed to be on a big paper. It was part of his identity. And I didn't, when I lost him, I remember thinking, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to have too much of my self-worth tied up in my job. But as a journalist, he did great. I mean, he came up via a route that doesn't exist anymore, from weekly papers to evening papers to morning regional papers to national newspapers.
It's how people got good as well.
Yeah, absolutely, it
is. And that's how that's why there were so many brilliant journalists. And not to say that there aren't great journalists now, but it is also, like you say, it's no longer getting your foot in, you know, to get your foot in at a lower level in terms of more regional, it's easier than now. It feels
very difficult.
Who you know, what you know.
Well, not even, partly that. And also talking a good game, you know. So how Boris Johnson can end up writing news reports that he just has made up. Anyone who was in Brussels with him will tell you he just made stuff up. And that was the same paper that my dad was on. So it's a mark of the decline, really, in all of British newspapers, but the Daily Telegraph in particular.
What do you think is the future of news as we know it?
I don't know, really. I think increasingly it's a plaything of the super rich. We should treasure the exceptions, like the BBC and The Guardian, run by the Scott Trust, the Financial Times, which manages to plough a very independent furrow. But almost all of the rest of it, even The Mirror now, of course, is owned by the same people that own The Express. But it does seem to be an exercise in buying influence. I suppose Rupert Murdoch has created that template, and a lot of other media owners have moved into it. The thing that gives me hope is the technology that allows people to build their own platforms, which isn't it hasn't happened on the scale that it might do yet. But I think that, you know, you can do everything, can't you, now? From making films. I can see a YouTube influencer doing news or doing comment or talking about current affairs. I'm not fully au fait with the world to know how many people are doing it already. But that wasn't an option when I was in my teens or my 20s.
Yes,
and I think you've got it with print. The internet lets you get to places that previously you never could have reached. Where, you know, and then you've got the organs that might let you do it, like Substack. But I think that if I was 30 years younger, I'd be very interested in cutting out the employer and trying to find a way of getting directly to the consumer.
That's very interesting. Do you think also with social media, obviously it gives people a direct line to you. Do you think if you're going to do that or if you're going to speak directly, you have to be thicker skinned?
Well, it depends on how much of it you see. It is optional. So when you start out and when Twitter first kicked off, I'd get into really quite lengthy rows with people who, in retrospect, weren't really worth the time of day. It's not natural at first to walk past a door and you know people are talking about you on the other side of that door. It's not natural to carry on walking.
Yeah.
It's a human impulse to put your ear to the keyhole and find out what they're saying. But if you reach a point in as a media figure where every door you walk past, there's a chance that there's going to be people on the other side of it talking about you, then the urge to find out what they're saying diminishes pretty quickly. So I would once have searched my own name on Google and possibly even on Twitter quite regularly, but hand on heart, I cannot remember. Well, I've got a book out at the moment, so I'm checking for reviews and comments on online, but I haven't searched for my name randomly for God knows how long, absolutely years. And if you use the safety functions responsibly, you kind of manage to steer clear of most of the really mad, unhinged nastiness. But yeah, if you're starting out and you're going to get into the business of offering up opinions for money, then I'm afraid the price that you're going to have to pay for that is receiving pungent opinions in return from people who aren't getting paid.
Does it ever get to you?
No. I mean, it must have done at some point. But one of the great advantages I have is that the people who really hate me are mostly disgusting racists.
Yeah.
So it actually becomes quite easy to convert it into a badge of honour. I worry for my kids sometimes. I don't like the idea of them being exposed to some of the bile that might come in my direction, more so from people in the business, perhaps, than from sort of random members of the public. But it's a fairly clear trade-off between all the amazing stuff that has happened to me career-wise. And if the price you pay for that is getting called names by Billy Buncher numbers with a bulldog avatar and a Nigel Farage poster on his bedroom wall, then I can live with that.
Yeah. How did you get into broadcast?
Mostly by accident. So I said I was good at talking.
You are good at talking.
When I was not very good at being a journalist. But what happens is you get invited onto TV and radio to talk about stuff. And now, initially, as a showbiz journalist, I'd be invited on to talk about Liam Gallagher's divorce from Patsy Kensit or something like that, about which I knew absolutely nothing. But of course, as most people, I'm sure, suspect, almost everybody on the telly talking about things knows nothing more than the people at home watching it do, that we're just a little bit better at seeming plausible and seeming informed. So, if you know, you're good at that, and then they invite you on to do a paper review, or they invite you on to talk about something that is a little bit out of your purview, out of your speciality area. So I just started doing that, and I really liked it. They give you some money, and they send a car for you, and your mum back in Kidderminster can hear you on the radio or see you on breakfast television was always a big one for mum. So I used to really enjoy doing all of that. And then someone came along and said, we're launching a new programme and we'd like you to co-present it. And I said, that's interesting. And they said, it's based in Norwich, so you would have to give up the newspaper job. And I was just reaching the point where I had those moments of going, I think you're in the wrong game, mate. Mm. And it happened very nicely. So we launched a show called The Right Stuff for Channel 5 with Anglia Television about more than 20 years ago now. And that was it. That was how I got started.
And was that successful?
I think so. I mean, it was an odd one. I did it with Matthew and a woman called Kate Silverton, who was latterly a newsreader at the BBC, and we had a really good time. And then we got caught up in politics, like media politics, not politics, and Granada bought the company. Anglia was, you know, being wound down a bit by Granada. The show moved back to London. They changed the format so that Kate and I had been on it every day, and now they wanted a more rotating panel, which I that hurt my ego a bit. So it kind of, that just sort of petered out. And then I did a couple of bits and bobs before LBC came along. So it was a popular show, and it was a bit ahead of its time. It, you know, you can't turn the telly on now without seeing some discussion show, some sort of, dare I say, some slightly manufactured row being conducted by people on the telly. I like to think we sort of steered clear of some of the cheaper tactics on that programme and did actually make shows that were a little bit more nourishing. And then it just happened very quickly, and then it disappeared very quickly. So I did that, and then they wanted to do an evening politics show for the second Blair election, so 2002 or 1. And they said, will you front that one? And you need a co-presenter. And so I did it with my wife, Lucy.
Who's also a journalist?
Yeah, very much. Not so much now, but she was then. And it just all seemed so easy. And then they offered me a chat show. So I did a regional chat show for ITV, which was quite exciting, called A Night with O'Brien, with a K, because the Anglia Television famous symbol was this big silver knight that used to spin around on a sort of podium. Nicholas Parsons, Sailor of the Century, you're too young for this, but I go, now, live from Norwich, it's the show of the week. And this was, again, part of my childhood. And I just kept getting offered all this stuff. And then Channel 5 said, would you make a documentary? And then my pure Alan Partridge moment, Channel 5 came to watch the recording of the ITV chat show. And the head of entertainment, Light Entertainment, said, oh, would you make a pilot for us? This is really good. We like this to go national. So we made a pilot for that. He came to watch it Friday night, it was, finished the record. It's never seen the light of day. Finished the record, and he said that night, right, we need to change the contracts. I want to put this out on air. It's definitely broadcast quality, and we are commissioning a series of chat shows presented by you. I think I was 28, 29 maybe. Goodness. Just 30, presented by you for national network television. And I remember having quite a good weekend, although there's always a little bit of fear, but imposter syndrome. And then he got fired on Monday morning. So he commissioned the chat show on the Friday night and got, which is, this is like Alan Partridge, yeah. Script editors would send it back for being too implausible. So all of this mad stuff happened in my first year as a broadcaster. And then it stopped dead. I didn't have an agent because I didn't think I needed one, because every time I picked up the phone, there was someone offering me a job. And then, boom, it died, absolutely died a death. And so I dealt with it, and I thought, I'm going to have to go back to newspapers then. And my wife said, I don't think you should, which looking back was her polite way of saying, you're not very good at it. But instead she said, oh, I think you're a really natural broadcaster.
You've got more time.
Yes. Exactly. So we gave it a year. And luckily it has started happening towards the end of that year.
You said there that you felt elements of imposter syndrome, and that surprises me.
Well, that's the public school education. That's the feet flapping under the water like that, where above the water you can seem very confident and very serene. I spent years waiting for a tap on the shoulder saying, yeah, right, you've had your fun. Back you get, back to measuring inside legs on Regent Street. Who do you think you are swanning around like this? Until relatively recently, actually, probably until I started writing books, which is something I'd always wanted to do. And the show went a bit ballistic in the last 4 or 5 years. But until then, yeah, I would definitely have sort of sighed resignedly If I'd run out of road, it wouldn't have come as a major shock to me.
Do you think your parents were interested in kind of job success? You know, if to think about it in the sense of you wanting to please parents.
No, it was never that. It was always for myself. I think they call it status anxiety. I always wanted to do well. Mum and Dad never really put any pressure at all on me, actually. Quite the opposite. When I was really struggling to get a gig in journalism, to get my first break in journalism, they'd begun the very difficult conversation of suggesting perhaps it was time to start thinking about something else. So there was never any... Also, I wasn't one of those kids that could afford to wait for a break. You know, I needed to be earning a living, certainly if I was going to stay in London. I was entirely placed it on myself, that. Entirely placed it on myself.
Let's come on to talk about the book. Why did you want to write this?
Simply because so many really stupid things have happened in our country in a relatively short period of time. And I kind of realised through my radio show and speaking to people and watching things quite closely that this was not a kind of congregation of coincidences. This is not a series of disconnected facts or disconnected events that have all accidentally happened at the same time. There is an ecosystem that has been created in our country that allowed really mad things to happen, like becoming the first population in the history of humanity to vote to impose economic sanctions on itself in 2016, like letting a man like Boris Johnson ascend to the highest office in the land, like having, I mean, when the book was commissioned, that was one of the key questions. How did we end up being a place where Boris Johnson could become prime minister? By the time I was finishing it, of course, that had evolved into how did we become a place where Liz Truss could become prime minister and swiftly drive the entire economy off a cliff? And the division and the hatred that has grown up in recent years as a consequence of the same ecosystem, the same three engines of influence, the current iteration of the Tory party, which is a very right-wing, very ugly creation, the right-wing media, which has got worse and worse through the course of my adult life, most obviously at the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph and the Murdoch titles, and then these weird so-called think tanks, which are basically just secretly funded lobby groups doing the business, representing the interests of big business, and yet they've managed over the course of the last 30-odd years to infiltrate almost every level of the media. And I thought that other people couldn't see what I could see. So I've written it all down.
When you're writing a book, obviously it doesn't happen overnight. Mm. And when you're in such a fast-paced political stance, surely things were becoming...
Oh, it's a nightmare. Seriously, the introduction, I could still be writing it now. And then they'd start doing terrible things. Like I used Dominic Raab and Suella Braverman in the introduction as examples of people who've been horribly, horribly overpromoted and whose careers will almost certainly end in shame and disgrace. Of course, Dominic Raab's career did end in shame and disgrace while I was still writing the introduction. Suella Braverman's career ended in shame and disgrace 2 weeks after the book was published. So there was never any... I had to just draw a line. So it came out at the beginning of November, but there's still events in it that were happening in the middle of August, which is almost unheard of for a book. And it's why there might be a few typos in it, because we simply didn't have time to... I delivered it very late. This wasn't the plan, and the publishers were very patient with me. But yeah, stuff just kept happening and still is, you know. I forget what the first story was that broke after I really couldn't go back to the text. I was already reading the audiobook by this point. Reading the audiobook was the final proof check. And by the time we got to the fourth day of reading the audiobook, the publisher said, we've got to press the button at the printers. So for the last quarter of the audiobook, I'm coming across mistakes and I'm thinking, oh no, that's already gone to the printers. But none of them are like libelous, at least, or like massively, massively damaging. But once you've got the thesis in place that this is a country where really, really stupid things can happen, really bad, crazy things can happen, and really bad, unqualified, unsuitable people can rise to the very top of politics and other areas. Once that thesis is in place, then there's proof of it every week. There's proof of it every week. I mean, the COVID inquiry, of course, was in the week that the book came out. And Cummings gets a chapter and Boris Johnson gets a chapter. And both of those chapters would have been a little bit longer if the COVID inquiry evidence had been given at the beginning of August instead of at the beginning of November. But it's fine. It's there. It's a historical document full of detail, evidence, and footnotes. I've never done a book with footnotes before. It made me feel like a proper grown-up.
I didn't know that much about think tanks, and there's quite a lot of, you know, politics that can be really alienating. And that's from somebody, you know, who has an interest, who tries to engage. And what I thought was interesting about the book is your ability to expose and to explain.
I hope so.
Things that are very complicated and events that happened a while ago.
Yeah.
That might not have stuck in your head, or you might have been too young, or
yes,
they might have, you know, been pushed under the carpet with a lot of other events, you know,
yeah,
or just
absolutely
turning your heads in another direction,
yes,
which is what it seems to do. How difficult do you think it is to condense?
I found it quite straightforward. I think once I'd got my central idea, so the title comes first.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally going to be called The Men Who Broke Britain,
mm-hmm,
but then they put Liz Truss in Downing Street. So I couldn't quite keep that title, although the Liz Truss chapter is very, very short. And so then it became How They Broke Britain. And once I established that what I'm trying to do is not just list all the bad stuff that's happened, but explain how we created an ecosystem, a country in which it could happen, it was actually quite straightforward. The 10 candidates for chapters presented themselves very easily. There were no sort of close run 11, 12 place characters. The mm-hmm 10 chapters presented themselves very easily. And then something quite magical happened, actually, which I haven't really spoken about before. And I couldn't quite believe it when it was happening. I'd keep finding stuff that proved I was right. So there are moments where you think this might look a bit conspiratorial, or this might look a little bit bonkers. But then I'd find out stuff that I hadn't known about or I'd forgotten. And it would prove a thesis of the book so complete, would just fit so perfectly. So, you know, when you do a bibliography at the end of a book like this, it doesn't necessarily mean you've read every single page of every single book in the bibliography. You use the index quite a lot. So you're looking up, for example, in a Murdoch biography, you might look up Andrew Neil and find out the interactions there in the bit. And I just kept finding things that made me go, God, you're right. There really has been, largely by accident, partly by design, there's been a convergence on this very right-wing ground, and they've dragged the whole country to where they were. And they've done it, in many cases, deliberately, and in some cases, opportunistically, and in mm-hmm other cases, accidentally. But it's all happened. And that's why I'm very proud of it, because I've kept the receipts. The receipts are all there. It's not just
yeah
me. As my previous books were a little bit more personal, a lot more personal. It's not just me offering up an opinion. It's me drawing a map with loads of grid references.
It's really interesting, again, because when I first understood the premise, I thought, wow, surely you're worried about libel or saying the wrong thing.
So it begins with the boiling frog analogy, the idea that they've turned the heat up so slowly and so incrementally that we haven't noticed what's been going on around us until we're cooked. And we're cooked.
Do you think that there is a way to fix?
Yes, I do. I mean, the ecosystem might be decades old, but actually the full ramifications of it are relatively recent. And I think of Amber Rudd at this point, who resigned twice from the cabinet just within the last 5 years. The first time because she had misled the House of Commons accidentally, inadvertently, over something Theresa May had presided over at the Home Office, and she'd been given duff information by civil servants, which she repeated in the House and resigned as a consequence of that. And then she resigned as business secretary under Boris Johnson in protest at the direction of traffic that Johnson and Cummings were taking the party in. Simple, straight resignation of both ministerial office and the whip. And people forgot that. People forget this. I forgot that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in the book, actually. It's something that I've thought about more. And that was not decades ago. That wasn't 100 years ago. That was 5-6 years ago. Less, in fact, in the case of the second resignation. It was 4 years ago. And that's what normal looks like. So normal can keep the madness at bay. Normal regulations, standards, rules, abiding by traditions and principles that have been in place for decades. That's what can keep the potential havoc that this ecosystem can wreak under control. So you take Amber Rudd as an example of what normal looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take Owen Paterson as an example of what abnormal looks like. And when he's found to have breached lobbying rules, found by, you know, a parliamentary inquiry, the response of the people at the centre of this book, the Boris Johnsons, the Jacob Rees-Mogg's, the Charles Moores, their response is to try and get their man off the hook. They literally sat down together around a table at the Garrick Club and said, we've got to start the Save Owen Paterson Society. So the response to a rule breaker from within their own little coterie is to try and get him off the hook and then to set fire to the rule book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rees-Mogg goes to Balmoral to mislead the late Queen about the prorogation of Parliament, but most of the right-wing media is presenting him as some sort of paragon of penny-farthing virtue. It's insane what's gone on. But as long as you stay calm and detail it and write it all down, you realise that the speed with which we've reached critical mass could be emulated. You could get back to a semblance of normality at a similar speed. You've just got to care about the stuff that keeps the bad stuff at bay, and I think some politicians do. Amber Rudd did; she was a Tory. Keir Starmer does; he's Labour. So I'm a lot more optimistic than I was when I finished the book. Actually,
have any of them reached out?
No. I think most of the right-wing media are pretending it doesn't exist. Although the Daily Telegraph website gave it to Lawrence Fox's girlfriend to review, which I thought was very novel, very novel commissioning. But otherwise, I think they're pretending it hasn't happened, up to and including the point that it got to number 4 in the Sunday Times bestseller list in the week of release. So it comes slightly hard, I imagine, to ignore it completely.
Well, James O'Brien, thank you so much for coming on the Radio Times podcast.
Thank you. I had a lovely time.
If you enjoyed this episode, you might like to listen to my conversation with Sky's political editor, Beth Rigby, or Channel 4's news anchor, Krishnan Guru Murphy. Both can be found by scrolling back through the Radio Times podcast feed. Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please do follow, rate and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing.